Among the homeless, fear of arrest and eviction, not fear of inadequate medical care, is everyone's central anxiety. The war on drugs has resulted in a vertiginous rise in arrests in the United States, institutionalizing a massive multi-billion dollar carceral complex that is off the charts by international standards. Over the past 30 years, there's been a fourfold increase in the state and federal prison population in the U.S. For almost two generations, the U.S. incarceration rate has been 6 to 12 times higher than that of any nation in the European Union. This vertiginous rise in the U.S. prison population has been primarily driven by the war on drugs, manifested in an over fourfold increase in the number of drug offenders admitted to state prison in 1998, for example, compared to 1984. And our zero tolerance ideology in the United States specifically incarcerates often vulnerable youth for simple possession rather than sending them into treatment. Now, tragically, this has also created what really is a form of apartheid, I mean, in the technical South African term, because this is a legally enforced apartheid. De facto, in the sense that it's unconscious and not purposeful, but it's in our statistics of racialized inequality with respect to incarceration at extraordinarily differential rates, and the future promises worse for us in terms of how we're setting up our youth. Now, despite this massive investment of resources and law enforcement, heroin has fluctuates a little bit year to year, but it's more or less never been cheaper on the streets of the United States. In fact, the street price of heroin dropped over 60% from 1993 to 2004. It did blip up some with 911. There's an issue, actually, just the current issue of the International Journal of Drug Policy that has all the statistics in detail. I just got the issue yesterday. I wasn't able to translate it into a slide. On the ground, among the homeless, the war on drugs takes the form, concretely, of periodic police raids in which all their possessions, their blankets, sleeping bags, clothing, tarps, their syringes, are ground up into garbage trucks, as if their crucial basic survival possessions were useless trash. Now, more importantly, the police, even in San Francisco, and even more so in Philadelphia, intermittently arrest and inconsistently arrest street addicts on the charge of intent to sell controlled paraphernalia when they carry too many syringes in their possession. Consequently, addicts minimize the number of syringes that they have on their body and in their camps. And this is a terrible detriment to the public health services that we've instituted that have proved very effective at curbing HIV and hepatitis C and abscesses, the needle exchange programs. But the problem is you simply can't use a needle exchange program efficiently because most of them have a close to one-on-one exchange rule. Philadelphia gives out 10, but then after that it's a one-on-one exchange. And an addict simply won't walk an extra mile, take a bus, take time out of his hustle or her hustle if they're not going to get a large supply of needles, and they can't risk that. So it's a tremendous waste of public health resources, where you have the police literally sometimes arresting the addicts as they walk away from needle exchanges and then requiring. As a matter of fact, in my neighborhood, the needle exchange was closed down by a vigilante group with loudspeakers, and has been forced into a fixed office. And this Puerto Rican community is no longer getting needle exchange services. They're simply not going to go to Erie, where the fixed site is, and take the time to get the needles. So I want to just read you some fieldwork notes then that highlight the systematic effect of law enforcement at the micro level in augmenting risky practices. Fear of arrest, as I've been saying, discourages possession of syringes and encourages injectors to hide paraphernalia in unsanitary locations and relegates the injection process to filthy, hidden locales. And so these are my colleague Jeff Schoenberg's fieldwork notes. There's been yet another round of evictions, and Hank looks like like absolute hell. His eyes are so puffy that I ask him if he has been in a fight. They wiped me out again. I went for a drink at the corner, and when I returned, there was the CHP, California Highway Patrol, and Caltrans, the people that maintain the highways. I'm tempted to get my gun and shoot the next Caltrans truck that I see. He tells me that the Mexican worker, in quotes, ripping down his shack, probably he was actually a prisoner from San Quentin, had already put on, because that's their job, is to clean up the homeless along the highways, had already put on his suede jacket. When he asked for it back, the officer in charge threatened to arrest him. As he talks to me, he starts shivering so hard that he has to hug himself across his chest to steady himself. We can see that's a sign of withdrawal symptoms coming along, his uncontrolled shivering. Max walks by, and when he sees Hank shivering and hears about his eviction, he puts his arm around him, his shoulder, and offers to treat him to a taste of heroin. They immediately head to Max's encampment, where they set a candle on a pizza box and prepare to cook a bag of heroin. Max has only one syringe, and it is clogged. When he tries to rinse it, water sputters out the end. Hank reaches into his sock and pulls out his needle and hands it to Max, muttering apologetically that the CHP took all of my cleanings. The syringe has been used so many times that the numbering on the chamber is worn off. Max squints at it, frowns, and notes a burr on the tip of the needle. Hank takes it back, licks the point to confirm the defect, and quickly files it down on a rock, alternately licking and filing until he can no longer feel the burr with his tongue. I actually stopped believing in germ theory. They're not getting abscesses every single time they inject. It's really remarkable how strong the body is. Max is the one treating. So Hank hands the needle back to Max and eagerly waits for his turn to prepare a cotton shot with the leftovers. Now, the homeless heroin injectors and crack smokers we befriended do not usually engage in this kind of very risky, direct needle sharing. They were all well-educated about the risks of propagating blood-borne diseases, especially HIV, from injection drug use. Direct needle sharing usually only occurred between lovers and between very close companions, known as running partners on the streets and street parlance. On the occasions when direct sharing did occur, between casual acquaintances, as in this case, or sometimes even between strangers, it is usually in the midst of a law enforcement offensive because one of them is going into withdrawal symptoms, often because of some kind of mishap in that's criminally related. Now, more subtly, the pariah status of illegality encourages street addicts to pursue drugs with a self-destructive intensity akin to devotion, as if they had nothing left to lose. It foments a sense of solidarity, as you saw between Max and Hank in the fieldwork note, and purpose among them. In this case, it was also a romantic love affair. They develop what's sometimes called, jokingly, a hope to die with my boots on identity. And they celebrate their outlaw status, hurting themselves and others around them in the process. In a sense, you can think of them, these social networks of homeless users, as forming a community of addicted bodies, celebrating their commitment to flooding the bloodstream and brain synapses with heroin obtained by any means necessary. Hence their self-identified term, righteous dope fiend, which that's where we put it in our book. Now, they also, the other alternative identity that often competes with and simultaneously exists with the celebrated outlaw is that of the broken down and depressed wino, festering with sores, rarely bathing, body scarred, in this case with necrotizing fasciitis, which actually is more common where there's Mexican black tar heroin. Luckily we don't see it as much on the East Coast where we have primarily Colombian whiter powder. The criminalization, not just of heroin, but also of syringes. By the way, heroin, Mexican black tar, doesn't cross the Mississippi River. And it's led to lower rates of HIV west of the Mississippi River and higher rates east because it's a sticky material that you have to rinse out with your needles. So when you are, if those of you that have clinical practices, when you see someone that's just completely hopeless and is not going to, you know, use a clean needle each time, tell them to at least rinse with water. Because it actually works for HIV. It doesn't necessarily work for hepatitis C or abscesses, but I would tell, you know, if my son was tragically addicted, I would beg him to at least rinse my water. Sorry about that diversion. The criminalization, not just of heroin, but also of syringes, as we saw, as well as the enforcement of local city ordinances against public intoxication, urination, and sleeping outside, pushes drug users into the furthest margins of public space. The act of injection, as we know, in our field, represents a brilliant medical technology for treatment and prevention of vaccinations, the miracle of the modern age. It is the symbol of public health prevention, vaccines, and biomedical treatment. Yet, here it becomes an image of self-destructive pathology and of abuse. And it's been, this is in the frame of laws that make one substance illegal and another one not to inject in certain conditions, making filthy nooks and crannies that are optimal for spreading infectious diseases, such as this shooting gallery, become the safest, objectively, refuges for an injector like this, further reinforcing, of course, his or her outcast and outlaw sense of self. Now, contrast this to what goes on in Europe with their public health models of instituting safe injection sites supervised by nurses and social workers. It's rather dramatic. I mean, imagine having that in the United States. You're a raving maniac kook to even propose it. Actually, they are trying to propose it in San Francisco, where they are raving maniac kooks, but that's why I came to Philadelphia. I wanted to be in a real place where people really understand America. Not live in that bubble. Now, we often documented direct contradictions between delivery of medical services and law enforcement. And I'll read a few from our fieldwork notes. Over the past year, Hank became a frequent flyer, as they call him, in the county hospital's emergency room, with over a half dozen long-term admissions in the ICU. First, his back condition became compounded by double pneumonia. Then came a diagnosis of colon cancer, followed by radiation therapy. Soon he was complaining of mysterious seizures that he called mini-strokes and spent several weeks in the ICU. Hank has been released from the hospital and is back at his camp, nodding and swaying on his feet. With Hank's permission, we asked the physician on our ethnographic team to consult Hank's medical record from the past 16 months. According to his file, the neurologists originally thought that the seizures were caused by localized lesions in his brain, but could not locate them on a CAT scan. His repeated spikes of fever suggested an infection and were diagnosed as an empedema, a brain abscess. They conducted a lumbar puncture to test his cerebral spinal fluid and also found meningitis. They prepared to conduct brain surgery to drain the pus from his brain, but he meanwhile responded well to an aggressive new regimen of triple therapy antibiotics. This was what prompted the hospital to then release him back to the street with instructions to take his antibiotic cocktail, ampicillin, vancomycin, and ceftriaxone. Thanks. Hank's official discharge papers stated, oh, I should have practiced this, psoas myositis and lumbar osteomyelitis and Clostridium bacteria, COPD, and then a bunch of those discs. 3 days later, the police confiscated Hank's medications. Hank, there was nothing I could do. They seen pill bottles, and they seen my name all over it. They even spread my pills all over the hood of their car, taking their pictures like there's something illegal. I asked them, can I have my medication? They told me, no, this is evidence. We think you're dispensing drugs here. What do you mean, dispensing drugs? It's got my name on the bottle. Then why do you have it hidden here on state property? So no one will steal it. This is my safe spot in the woods. Do you expect me to carry all these pills around with me? Now, Jeff interrupting. Actually, what I cut out was that he had the sort of a PTSD thing with Vietnam, and it was this long thing about I was a Vietnam vet, which ended up not being true, but it's definitely his reality. Jeff, let's go to the hospital right now. Better yet, I'll call an ambulance for you so you don't have to wait 5 hours in triage. Hank, why? So they can send me right back out again? Now, meanwhile, Hank's running partner, Petey, at this time, was himself vomiting blood when he woke up each morning and was severely underweight with infected sores on his feet and aches in his legs. It was getting harder for him to stand panhandling with his sign for so many hours on end. You can probably diagnose it. It's cirrhosis. Tina tells me that the police arrested P today for panhandling yesterday and found 3 used syringes in his pocket. They charged him with selling syringes, and he has a September 10 court date. With sympathy, she adds, and his GA, general assistance, check was cut this month for missing the appointment. Now, despite, I want to just, the last section, I want to move on to the irrationality of drug treatment in prison. That's where it's primarily delivered in the United States. Despite the rhetoric of politicians in the U.S. calling for treatment on demand, it's simply not available in the United States. Most addicts, consequently, literally recover from their addiction on the cold floor of a prison cell, throwing up in agony in cold sweats with no medical supervision whatsoever. And frequently, they're jeered at by the guards and preyed upon, as I unfortunately found out the hard way in Philadelphia, by their fellow inmates. A judge mandated, I'll give you a story. Well, actually, I'll just cut out of that so we have more time, and I'll just I'll slip to what I saw in the Philadelphia prison. In my new field work here in Philadelphia, I unfortunately was able to document from the inside the routinely abusive form drug arrests take on a typical Saturday night. I was picked up on a police sweep of a drug-selling corner in which several street sellers were arrested, but so were several neighborhood youth who were simply hanging out, like me, bored, passing the time. They were actually chit-chatting with me and kind of excited because I was tape recording their stories of police brutality. Now, I spent the next 18 hours in a precinct holding cell waiting to be arraigned before a judge and was forbidden from making any phone calls. Over half of the 2 to 3 dozen men and women who were arrested that night in that particular precinct, I would estimate, belonged in the hospital, not the precinct holding cell, including, unfortunately, me, as the police had taken the liberty of kicking me after handcuffing me and fracturing with my face on the ground and fracturing my ribs. But my cellie, as one cellmate is called in the prison scene, was in much worse shape than I was, as were many of the other people. And it was simply from opiate withdrawal. He had been in jail for 16 hours and was in acute opiate withdrawal. It's a terrible thing to see, and it's a much worse thing to see when you're in a solitary confinement. These cells are made to be alone, but because of the arrests, there's 2 of us. There's no place for 2 people to lie down in the cell for 18 hours. And there's a little filthy toilet where he can't throw up anymore because he's emptied his gut already. And he's just moaning and dry heaving. And he wasn't the only one. One hears this noise of throwing up all through the precinct hallways, echoing through the precinct building. Now, all of a sudden, I hear some screaming and running in the hallway as a bevy of guards invade a cell door 3 doors down from me. From their conversation, I can barely make out that it sounds like an inmate has slashed his wrists. Walking back down the hallway, I hear one of the guards chuckling to the other one. He's a sick individual. The other guard adds, also with levity, well, now he's not getting nothing. We're not even going to let there be any tops on his waters. Apparently, this inmate had attempted to slash his wrists with the top of the water bottles that they give inmates once a day. Another friendlier guard asks with some concern, how bad is it? And the loudmouth guard responds dismissively, it's not too bad, just a lot of bleeding. Now, coincidentally, when I was finally released, as I said, 18 hours later, I was released actually with this individual who had attempted suicide. He had some gauze taped to his wrists. I'm not medically trained, but he is someone that one would immediately identify as having some kind of serious organically cognitive, some sort of serious cognitive challenge. He couldn't hold his head still or focus his eyes, and he smiled inappropriately at everything, making naive statements to the guards, to the judge that released him on his own recognizance for bail, and to all the inmates surrounding him. He was talking in his sort of gentle little boy's voice about not having taken his medications and needing to take them. As we waited for the guards to give us back our possessions, I urged him to go straight to the hospital emergency room and offered to accompany him to get an x-ray also. He nodded his head obediently, saying something like, yeah, I better go to the hospital before I do something bad to myself. But as soon as we stepped out onto the street, a white cigarette butt in the gutter caught his attention, and he pounced on it, thinking it was a piece of crack that someone had dropped. And this kind of compulsive, obsessive behavior among chronic crack smokers is so common that there's a slang word for it on the street, doing the chicken, it's called. And it's from bending over and repeatedly grabbing at any little pebbles that have a funny color, because you're sure that they're pieces of crack that you can smoke. Now, my attempts to remind him, come on, let's go to the hospital, falls obviously on deaf ears. He doesn't pause. He does pause and politely tells me in his extraordinarily naive little boy's voice, nah, I think I have something better to do. Or actually, I think it was, nah, I think I have something else I want to do. I mean, because it was like right, it was almost like fetal alcohol syndrome, just telling you exactly honestly what's going through his head. And he runs off in the direction of the street corners where crack is sold. In conclusion, very briefly, I think there is a tremendous potential for the health fields to redress the imbalance between law enforcement and health in the provision of services to vulnerable populations in the United States, because this country is wasting immense amount of funds on the war on drugs internally to no rational avail. The challenge is to carve back the institutional and service spaces that have been taken away from the field of health and redress the distortions imposed in our own service delivery, whether it's the prescription of analgesics that was noted in the previous presentation. Because of zero tolerance, repressive, punitive models of containing addicts and poor people and unruly people in favor of therapeutic models, and preventative models that have proven to be not only more humane, but cheaper and more effective than law enforcement. Now, there's also room for direct collaboration with law enforcement, especially, for example, in the field of treatment, where mandatory treatment often leads to good outcomes and can be coordinated with therapeutic treatment very, very effectively. Actually, that worked for that guy that you saw in the hospital with cirrhosis. He's now working in a VA hospital as an orderly, because a judge mandated him to treatment. And he was lucky to have been in the military, so he actually got a great treatment program. They have terrific treatment programs in the VA. There's military funding for that. I think it's our responsibility to develop protocols, for example, on how to deal with the ravages of police brutality, which many of us see routinely, I would suggest, in emergency rooms, especially in North Philadelphia, but here as well, I would think. We already have mandatory protocols for child abuse and to a certain extent for domestic violence. Why not for police brutality? Similarly, the dangerous, unhealthy conditions in jails and precinct holding cells should be subject to health inspections. There was two people that were dragged out coughing with asthma and sent after 9 or 10 hours of being in the holding cell and sent to the emergency room. That was one of the other things I heard there. The mentally ill and the physically ill and the traumatized should be immediately sent to hospitals, not to jails or high security prisons, where they are often brutalized and sometimes are turned into raving maniac monsters, literally, confined in padded cells and just throwing their feces at their guards. There's a new book about this, the maximum security prisons and its vertiginous rise in the United States. It's just by Werner Rhodes. It's terrifying and completely unnecessary. The challenge is great, but I think it's eminently doable, because medicine and health have tremendous appreciation and credibility among the general population. They are not seen as politically motivated. Nurses are seen as neutral experts and trusted caregivers. We should, I think, step up to that privileged position in society and in science and in policy and confront head-on the ill effects of law enforcement, which so ravaged the socially vulnerable. Thanks.